with that, I will. The topic of tonight's meeting is working step 12 with the sponsee. And Tim will share anything between 30 and 45 minutes on the topic, after which the floor will be opened for questions rather than the typical sharing. And with that, I will now hand over to Tim.
Thanks. Tim Alcoholic. Alistair, can you hear me properly? Okay, good. I just changed my audio setup, so I needed to check. Well, this is a big topic. Now, the thing is, I specifically haven't planned this because it's too big a topic to do an outline of. And there's no need to, because it doesn't need to be squeezed into 1 week. So we can do this at whatever pace suits people. But what I am going to do is come at this systematically so that we know what we've covered. And where I'd start off is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Now, that doesn't look like it's something you can take someone through. It's something that's supposed to happen automatically as the result of doing the steps. Except it doesn't always happen. Now, don't tell anyone this. It will frighten all the newcomers. But sometimes you get to step 12 and, there are some pieces missing. And I'll tell you some experiences that I had. I think I did have a spiritual experience the first time round. This is the test. If you suddenly discover you really want to help people, even though you don't like people, if you like people already, you can't really test it because you wanted to help people. But if really people are not your thing and you discover yourself feeling, not even wanting to, but feeling this overwhelming obligation to not run away after the meeting. If there's someone suffering in the meeting, you feel this like magnetic pull that it's the right thing to do, to go up to them, to offer them your number. You're looking round automatically at the end of the meeting for who's about to run off. If you're going for fellowship, half of you've got one eye looking at where you're going, the other eye looking at who's in the room, who's feeling left out, who might want to be invited along. It happened automatically. I won't do the full history of my first 15 years in recovery. But I did a much more thorough round of steps when I was about 15 years sober. And the same thing happened when I completed, and this is the interesting thing. It wasn't when I was halfway through amends. It was when I completed the last amend. There was this rather overwhelming shift, and the same thing. I went to a meeting, and my perception of the meeting and the overwhelming kind of groaning need for help in aggregate of the people in the room was really struck me. So a spiritual experience is not feeling all la-di-da and going through the, tripping through the tulips. It's awakening. Oh, I think I've lost some used to.
Yeah, we've lost it, Tim.
Okay, I think I've got you back. Have you got me back? Good. It's this overwhelming sense of responsibility and connection with other people. You feel what is going on around you. And that's why you have to do something about it. You develop automatically an empathy for what people are experiencing. And you can't just be an island. I don't want to be political about this, but Noam Chomsky, is it Noam Chomsky? Or is it someone else who says reality skews left? Because once you become aware of how people in other parts of the world or in your own country are suffering, you've got to have a very hard heart indeed to turn a completely blind eye to it. So the more in touch with the reality you are, the more you're aware of now exactly what you do about that. That's a political question, but the awareness that there is need out there. And I think this should happen automatically, but bemusingly, it doesn't. And also, this fails to happen on a, I'm afraid, on a fairly regular basis. Now, it doesn't mean you just throw the baby out with the bathwater at this point. So, well, you know, bugger that. Sometimes a few things need to happen. Sometimes people need to have a second surrender in recovery. So what, okay, so what happens a lot, and I did this in some ways over the first 8 years, is you think, now I've got my marbles back. You know, AA is very, very good. It's got me sober and it's made me a marginally nicer person, or at least less disagreeable person. There's the opportunity to go and make something of myself in the world. And so I focused very heavily on my career in my first 8 years. And so my concern for the initial overwhelming concern for other people faded as I became reinterested in my own affairs. And what brought me back to the table, really, at around 9, 10 years, back to the AA table, was the failure of that system. So sometimes people get to step 12 and there's a bit of a sort of, it's a bit of a damp squib. So what's supposed to have happened hasn't happened. And sometimes you need to wait for life to fill in the missing piece. And it will either be adversity or unresolved, very deep conflicts which come to the surface and make themselves felt, or people going all out with a life on self-will, which then fails, and then they crash, and then they're now you're interested. Now you really give yourself to the path. So often, I think it's like with fairy lights, with Christmas lights. And I think the new ones are different, but the old ones from when I was a child, if there was one bulb in the chain which didn't work, the whole chain didn't work. So you had to go and test each little bulb one by one. And then when you found the right bulb and twisted it, the whole chain lit up. And I think it can be like that with step 12, that if you get, you get there and someone hasn't fully woken up, it's not because the whole thing is dead in the water. It's because there are a couple of bulbs that need twisting. There are also some basic points which come out of the earlier steps, which sometimes people understand them intellectually, but it hasn't gone all the way through and it can take a while for it to click. And the two in particular, I remember a friend of mine in the middle of step 4 and 5, he said his big realization, it was he had a nemesis. It's a good word. He had a nemesis, not just an enemy, not just someone that got up his nose, but a nemesis at work. And he was doing the inventory in the step 5 on the nemesis at work. And he said, my realization was this: oh, I'm the arsehole. I have no idea I was the arsehole. So suddenly realizing that I'm the arsehole, that's a spiritual experience. Sometimes people get to step 12 and that's not there yet. The other thing is, now people work on this at different speeds and get this point at different speeds. And this is something which runs so counter to the way the world operates. People are entirely forgivable for not getting this point, especially even in AA. This is not always well understood in AA, that I never react to a situation. I'm only ever reacting to the story that I'm telling myself about the situation. And the story that I'm telling myself about the situation is generated by algorithms programmed into me when I was about 6. And the invisible bit of my brain, the bit under the bonnet, is processing situations that occur around me using old algorithms and churning out a story where I'm innocent and everybody else is guilty and it is a world of woe and they need to be destroyed. That's the basic plot. And even though you're suffering, you know, as Annika Jawa says, that you're still the hero of the dream. You know, what, even though it's a nightmare, it's still all about you. So it's deadly because it's so attractive. And so sometimes that lesson that I'm creating my own suffering hasn't got through, not fully. So it's understood intellectually, but it's not there all the way down. And also another thing people can be forgiven for thinking is because it's so widespread in the various fellowships and then society as a whole. Once you've discovered all of these problems and psychological difficulties, you have to sort of do something with them. And my experience is you don't. Once you know what the problem is from the first 11 steps, the job is then to abandon self, stop being a human shield for your own ego, and get out of the way. And it honestly, I think that, I mean, therapy and things like that have been great for helping me get in touch with what's actually going on, not providing solutions, but helping to thaw me out and to sensitize me, to stop me running on autopilot and to get me to see what is actually going on. But then the steps, do something with that, analyze that systematically. And I think that the real awakening in beginning of step 12 is the realization is all of that stuff that I've uncovered and discovered needs to be discarded. I don't need to do anything with it. It's the, as my sponsor says, the bloated nothingness of self. And the way I do that is by getting involved in service. Now, once people understand that the only solution, the only way out, is the only way to heal is to throw yourself completely unreservedly into a life of service. And it's a sandwich. The bottom of the sandwich is a slice of bread, which is looking after yourself. So you've got to look after yourself physically and spiritually.
Tim, we've lost you again.
Right, I'm back. Can you hear me again?
Yep.
Okay. So once you realize that the solution involves service, as I don't know how far I got into the sandwich analogy, bottom layer, bread, looking after yourself. If you don't have the bottom layer, the filling goes everywhere. So you've got to have a bottom layer, which is looking after yourself. And then you've got the filling, and then you've got the top layer of bread, which is you know, enjoying the world, having a bit of fun. But the key element of the sandwich, the bread is just the vehicle. The filling is being of service. People, a service is hard. So I only did it because I realized it was the only way out. So sometimes there's a tedious process when the first nine steps are completed. There's a tedious process of people coming to the realization that service is the only way out. And you don't have to like it. You just have to recognize it. There's a difference between liking it and recognizing it. You just have to recognize it and do it. And then you discover all of these emotional difficulties gradually melt away because you can't be bothered. You haven't got time. You spend enough time away from something that when you come back to it, you realize you see it for what it is, but you need the time away to see it for what it is. And I think that's what service does. So if there hasn't been a kind of loud pop in step 12, beginning of step 12, where the person wakes up and is just desperate to be of service, if that hasn't happened, if you wait, life will present the circumstances where the person, all of the other options are knocked on the head one by one by one until that's the only one that's left. When service is the only option that's left, it lights up somehow. So you stick with people. You don't drop, if they're not sort of super interested in service, you don't drop them. You keep them on board as long as they're willing to be on board and hope that life does the job that you're unable to do. And eventually everyone gets it, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And sometimes other obsessions or compulsions are the great persuader. It talks about alcohol being the great persuader. And I think other obsessions or compulsions, what Clancy refers to as the obsessions of the mind. He doesn't go into detail, but you know what he means. Everyone's got their own. So having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. So how do you sponsor someone through that? Well, first of all, you've got to understand what that actually means, carrying the message. There are two types of service. There's service, which is the direct carrying of the message, and then there's service, which enables the carrying of the message. So the direct carrying of the message would be sponsorship and sharing in the meetings and talking to Susan and Clive after the meeting, and going to rehabs, going to treatment centres, doing encounters with alcoholics in the world outside. Then anything that enables service is all the service structure stuff, running a group, and also talks to professionals, which enables the message to be carried, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. Now, the first thing to make clear is that although the second type, the service which enables the message to be carried, is terribly important, it's not the high octane stuff. It's not the good gear. So it does get you out of yourself, but it's administrative largely. It's sponsoring other people who have similar psychological problems to you, but you can see how ridiculous they are in someone else, whereas they seem so important in oneself and real. And you see it in someone else and you think, oh, they're completely nuts. Therefore, I must be completely nuts, and things melt away. The second thing that happens when you see people, and this is why sponsorship is so important, you see people who've done the most appalling things, but they're the same appalling things that you've done. And you look at them. What was the phrase that someone used the other day? The infantile charm of the hapless. So you see this poor old soul, you know, wandering through the world, messing things up and hurting people. But you see this sort of innocent child who's doing it. You don't see this evil monster. You see this poor creature who's condemned by whatever is going on inside them to behave this way. And then you think, oh, my God, I'm like that. So I'm not the monster that I thought, just because you are not your own behavior. And there's a story which is very long, which is one of the Baal Shem Tov stories, where the punchline is, when you hear your own story told back to you, then you're healed. And I think that's why we sponsor other people. So the most useful thing that someone who is, let's say, 1 year sober, 2 years sober, 3 years sober, and new to step 12, but still full of psychological maladjustments, the most useful thing they can do is sponsor other people and see their own maladjustments reflected in the people who are attracted to them. That will do 1,000 times more good than any wise words that you can pass down the tubes. So whenever they come to you, you pick them up, you turn them round, you wind up the key in their back, and you push them in the direction of sponsoring other people. Now, one has to engage with the problems and the psychological stuff a little bit, but it's about 10% of the deal. It's got to be 90% action, 10% psychological, you know, unpicking. So you point them in the direction of helping other people. But what do I encourage people to do? Some people naturally attract sponsees. I've talked about my friend Melody. I think she had a homing beacon installed in her, and wherever she went, there was this, you know, the character Linus in Peanuts, who's got the blanket and all the flies follow him wherever he goes. She was like that, but with sponsees and little and like sort of wet the waifs and strays. Wherever Melody went, there were these people following her, you know, in various degrees of mental breakdown. Pig pens, Evan says, not Linus. Some people have just got the personality that attracts people in trouble, and basically people who are very, very kind. Another character type which attracts people is people who are sort of disciplined and structured and have some or apparent authority. If you've got one of these two character types, then you're lucky. So people will run after you for sponsorship. If you're not particularly, if you don't sort of exude lots of motherly warmth, and you're not like sort of clear sergeant major type, then neither of which are particularly, admirable qualities. You either have them or you don't. Then you might have to work a bit harder. And there have also been times when I generally haven't had a huge amount of trouble finding sponsees, but there have been times when I have. So I just pass on what I did. I made myself omnipresent in local meetings. I just went to very large numbers of meetings, got there early, shared a lot, and stayed late. And eventually something sticks. But I made it my mission every day. I treated it as the most important thing I did every day, was to get to a meeting, get there early, talk to people, talk to as many people as possible, get numbers, exchange numbers. So if you haven't got sponsee, if the sponsee hasn't got sponsees, they can be putting all the time that would be going into sponsorship into placing themselves in a situation where they might acquire sponsees. And sometimes sponsorship is misunderstood. One doesn't have to have the formal title of sponsor to be sponsoring someone. And you can be sponsoring. So I remember saying to my sponsor many years ago about X someone. I said, I don't know if I should stop sponsoring him. He said, you haven't sponsored him for years. Just because if they're sort of, someone held a baseball bat above them in a dark alley and said, who's your sponsor? If your name would, creak out of their mouth, it doesn't mean you're actually sponsoring them. It just means you're the brass plate. So often people worry that they haven't got enough sponsees. Maybe they've got one or two or no sponsees, but they're talking to a lot of people and helping a lot of people. And that sponsorship in substance, if not in form. So always make clear to people that they're doing that the point here is to be making the effort. You get the points for effort, not for the, it's not like, the First World War One planes where they sort of stamped the enemy aircraft they'd shot down on the side of the aircraft. It's not about collecting numbers of people or accumulating a large number. It is about collecting their telephone numbers, but it's not about accumulating a large number of sponsees. But what it talks about, my sponsor's very strong on this. He says he talks about intensive work with sponsees from page 89, and also it talks about on page 19 most of us many of us spend much of our or most of us spend much of our free time engaged in the kind of work we're going to describe. So although it's got to be extensive time-wise, the real value comes from it being intensive, which means being super present for it and super engaged. Also, the other thing, if you're sponsoring a bunch of people and you've got sponsees who are just starting their sponsorship journey, don't expect them to hit the ground running, like instantly getting a lot of sponsees. Often people who are very new to this, it takes a long time before they get the first one that takes. So they may have to spend, 6 months to a year of getting, no one gets beyond 2 days or 4 days or a week or 2 weeks. And lots of people who are very, very iffy about AA are most likely to gravitate for sponsorship to people who are just at the beginning of the journey. And they're often the ones they can relate to the most. So naturally, people who are new at sponsorship are going to get the sponsees who are least likely to stick. Whereas if you've been around for a while, you're m most likely to get people who are, who already know what they want. So they're going to someone who's got, a longer track record. But the main thing is put the time, the people should be encouraged to put the time in, put the effort in, and somehow it will, if you, it's Lord Kitchener, if I dare, I'm not sure you're allowed to quote people from, with the word Lord in front of them anymore. I get, they're supposed to pull their statues down, I think. But anyway, Lord Kitchener said something to the effect of, if you don't let up in your fight with the enemy, if you don't let up, eventually, if you don't cave, they'll have to cave. If you don't surrender, they'll have to surrender. Someone's going to have to surrender. How this applies is if you desperately want, if you treat it as the number one priority, I want to be useful to God and to other people. Eventually it will click. If you hold yourself up against that and you pay attention, you pray, you meditate, you talk to people, the blocks will be removed one by one and then it will flow. And it's rather like, it's like a dam or something where there's one last piece in place. Once that last piece is removed, the whole dam collapses. So sometimes people are frustrated because they haven't got enough sponsees, or they've only got one sponsee, and they've actually removed nine of the blocks, but there's the 10th block that still has to go. When the 10th block goes, the whole thing starts to flow automatically. What you can do as well is encourage your sponsees to work with each other. So you get sponsee A to pre-process a chapter of the book with sponsee B, so that sponsee B is getting practice on how to talk someone through part of the book. So that means the work gets shared around. So it's not like, because you can't have this turn into a Ponzi scheme where everything kind of goes up the structure. The work should be shared out amongst all the people in the group pretty equally, because everyone needs to be useful. So you can't keep, that's why I always get sponsors to work with each other. And that's super helpful because people get to practice without having like the full responsibility of a sponsee. I think that's the main thing I want to say about sponsorship, or about sponsoring someone with like the beginnings of sponsorship. I think there's more. I'm going to make a note of this. Actually, why not? I was going to go on service, but there's a couple more things to say about how to sponsor someone through their sponsorship of other people. I think about 90% of my calls to my sponsor over the past 10 years have been how to handle a sponsee, in response to which I'm tearing my hair out. I won't say because of which, in response to which I'm the one that has the problem. When I've got a problem with a sponsee, it's not their problem. They're not doing it. They're just being themselves. I'm just having a reaction because of a pre-existing psychological maladjustment, which has come to the surface because of this person in front of me. So it's not about that. It's about me. And I think the real gold in sponsoring other people is helping them sponsor other people, helping them troubleshoot sponsees they're either having this massive emotional reaction to or seem to be getting nowhere with. And there you've got to have, you know, very minute discussion. So exactly what is going on? What have they reported to you? And it's not breaking confidences. It can be done perfectly anonymously. You know, I've got a sponsee who I'm talking to someone who, and you don't find out who they are. So it's sticking to principles, not personalities. But that's how you figure something out. You don't learn how to sponsor people in the abstract. You know the way in German they have all of these words, they have phrases they've acquired from English, or they think they're required from English. No English person uses them. So a projector is called a beamer, and a mobile phone is called a handy. And in if you go to any sort of German HR thing, they used to work in Germany, and they use this phrase, learning by doing. And of course, now I've never heard anyone in this country say learning by doing, but the Germans have picked this up and think that's something that we say that is very, very good, this learning by doing. But this is it's very useful, because this is how you learn how to sponsor people by sponsoring other people and then running to your sponsor saying, I want to push this person down the stairs, or they want to push me down the stairs. What do we do next? How do we not kill each other? Should I continue sponsoring this person? You know, or they've called with the same problem 18 times in a row. I don't know what to say. That's where the real benefit happens. And my sponsor, who's annoying, says things like, what is the gift that you are waiting to unwrap in this person who is being presented to you? I mean, just a horrible question. I don't want to know that. I want to know what I can say so I can fix the situation. I don't want to look inside and say, what, you know, what's the gift that I'm unwrapping here? And the other thing is, whoever is being attracted to you is not by accident. There is a clear, if you want evidence that the universe has some kind of structured system, you watch who gets attracted to you as a sponsor. And the people that are attracted to you, they really are attracted because you're vibrating on the same wavelength somehow. So something unresolved in you is resonating with something unresolved in them, which is why they've come to you. And then you get to work through the stuff you haven't resolved in you through by trying to help them. And I've gone through so many different phases of sponsees. I think I may be going through an angry young man phase. I haven't had one of those for a long time. It's one of the ones that comes around the mountain occasionally. I went through a long phase of very, very distraught women between 55 and 75. By the time I figured out how to sponsor a very distraught woman who'd been in recovery 20, 30, 40 years, between 55 and 75, by the time, and very difficult, by the time I figured it out, once I figured it out, and the last person in that category, it was working and it resolved itself. I was like, right, I can handle this type of sponsee now. Do you think anyone in that category has asked me since then? No. So this is, it's like a computer game. Once you complete the level, you don't get to do that level again. It's really annoying. You'd think you'd have a period where you get to practice the thing you've learned how to do, but no. You get sent an entirely new category of person, or as I say, comes around the mountain more than once. So you'll get to practice on whatever the category is again. It feels so like there is a curriculum here. And I think there is. It's whatever is at the top of your consciousness, which needs dealing with, is going to manifest whether you like it or not in the people around you. Because as Earl Purdy says, the reason you're attracted, you know, you're attracted to situations is because you've projected part of yourself out there. And you're, so what you're seeing in there is what you're seeing inside. And that's why you're attracted and you can't get away from it, because it's you can't get away from. Listen to the recording if that didn't sink in straight away. It took a while for me as well. So I think sponsorship is a really interesting thing. The other, just so we can park the other topics. There's the question of how to sponsor someone through the traditions and the concepts, the short version of which is don't, just they go and read the stuff. How to sponsor someone with the group and the service structure, and then how to sponsor someone with problems in other areas. So those are the topics to park. If Alistair, you can make a little note of that, but I think I'm pretty much done. I don't know if you want to see if there are any questions.
Thank you very much, Tim. The meeting is now open for questions for Tim, which can be done by the raised hand function in Zoom, or you can message me through the chat function and I will ask Tim directly. If all else fails, just wave at the camera and I will try to come to you in turn. And we do try to close around the hour mark, but we're not particularly strict about that. And with that, I'll open it up for questions. James.
Thank you. Thanks, Tim. Thanks for that presentation. And my question is, do you have any suggestions for when sponsees are, they're at the point where they're ready to be available to sponsor others, but there's resistance, and it's not so much because they don't, maybe they don't want to, but it's resistance of the whole, I don't feel ready, I'm not well enough, I don't, what am I supposed to do? Have you got any suggestions for how to respond to that, please?
Yeah. Okay, so sponsoring other people is like a sort of training program for yourself. So it's not the thing that you do when you graduate. It is the training program. And I've not graduated. I mean, even in the last 6 months, I've had situations where things have come in below the radar and I haven't figured out until I'm like excessively engaged. So you never take the first 100 people you sponsor are definitely the hardest. It starts to ease up significantly after 300. Let me just, so there's that prospect. So there is hope. There is hope here. Brian, my old sponsor, Brian says the first 20 years are the worst. So you're never going to stop learning. So I'm not ready. I can do it, but I'm not ready for it because you don't know who's going to call next. And each person is an entirely new situation. It's not painting by numbers, this. So no one's ready. But it's rather like a sort of wartime situation. Right, you've never been an air raid warden? Well, I'm afraid we've got an incoming Luftwaffe and we need to do something about it. So you're going to be the air raid warden. No one was trained to be air raid wardens before they had air raids. They had to learn it on the job. And I think it's like that with sponsorship. There is no way it's like swimming as well. You can't really learn swimming from a book, planking on a sort of chair or something. You just have to get in the water. In computer courses, they used to have to say this to people: you can't break it by pressing a button. So if you pressed your sponsee's buttons, you haven't broken them. The buttons were already there, and they're being pressed all day long. You're just one of a stream of people pressing those buttons. All you're seeing is you pressing them. You're not seeing all the other people. Now, one should aim to be kind and temperate and moderate and so on, but it doesn't matter if you leak because you're not a, we're not professionals, so it's okay to be a human. God, the people who've sponsors and other old times who've leaked on me, who I've exasperated. If you go to someone's house when you're 2 weeks sober at 11:30 on at night and beg to be let in, you will exasperate them, just in case you haven't tried them. And it was right for them to be exasperated and to let that show because I was then learning how people, ordinary human beings, respond to my behavior. Professionals will keep a facade up and won't show it. So people don't get to experience the consequences of them dicking professionals around because the professional has to remain professional. One of the amazing things about sponsorship is you get to see the human reaction to your engagement with them. So you don't have to be like super poised and professional. No, you have to be yourself. Now, obviously, this is a journey. Some people are naturally much nicer than me. I mean, this is after 28 years work. So you can imagine what I was like when I started off. You don't have to be all like super nice and pleasant and loving. You have to be on a journey towards being more pleasant and moderate and temperate and genial and approachable and all of those things. But you don't have to be fixed, in other words, to sponsor people. Tom Weston says if everyone in his first meeting had been serene, pleasant vegetarian joggers, he wouldn't have gone back. So maybe it's the humanity and the spikiness and the fact that if you're still, as someone else says, pardon my French here, if you're still all piss and vinegar, those might be characteristics which the person can relate to. They couldn't. I remember going to ask someone to sponsor me when I was like 8 years sober, and he was so nice and he was so placid and peaceful, and he was an organist, probably played really quietly, and he freaked me out. I wanted someone with a bit of punch and pizzazz, someone with an edge. So if your sponsee still got an edge, good. As for, well, I'm still effed up, what do I have to offer? Okay, so your job, there are different types of sponsors for different purposes. My sponsor specializes in doing profound psychological rearrangements of very messed up people. But that's his personal deal. He's good at that, so he does that. Other people, their job is to show them the mechanics. This is where you go every day. This is what you do. This is how you share at a meeting. This is what this bit in the book means. This is what the complete, no psychological stuff, no getting in there to the detail, just showing them the practical ropes. So there's a great line in chapter 7 where it says, having had the experience yourself, the experience of the 12 steps, having had the experience yourself, you can be a much practical use to the other person. So whatever experience the person has can be deployed in the sponsorship. And it doesn't matter if you're not great at like unraveling psychological doodads. Send them to someone who's good at that for those types of topics. But there's whatever the person has learned they can pass on. So somewhat, I don't think people need be frightened about it. And that what you can tell them is if you're frightened of sponsoring someone because you don't know how you're going to respond to a particular thing they throw at you, all you do is you get them to write on a piece of paper above the chair where they sit and take sponsee calls. I'm going to think about how to respond to that. I'll call you back later. And then they get to call you as their sponsor to say, they've just said this. What do I say next? And then you tell them what to say next. And then they go and say the thing you told them to say. And then 5 minutes later, they've had to do the same thing. I'm going to have to call you back. And then this goes back and forth. You know, and gradually people can always press the pause button and retreat and come back for further information. By the way, if you're ever talking to someone, they say, I'm going to need to call you back later. It's because they need to call their sponsor, probably. So you've just thrown them a curveball. So, you know, kudos to you. I think we should get points for making our sponsors talk to their own sponsors. That there should be, rather than chips for length of sobriety, you know, how many times this week have you caused your sponsor to pause a call halfway through to like regain their composure or go and have a, you know, some white bread to calm them down? So there's nothing to be frightened of. And if it doesn't work out, I mean, the sponsee, if it's not working for the sponsee, like the grand sponsee will figure that out and go somewhere else. And if your sponsee, if, I mean, sometimes, you know, there's a great line, have the grace to know when you're out of your depth. Sometimes I've had sponsees where I'm just out of my depth and I'm like, I kick them upstairs to Joe or to someone else. I can't deal with it. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. So your sponsee, if it gets too psychologically fraught and entangled, can step away from it. So there's no risk. As Clancy says, there is no such thing as dictatorship sponsorship, because as soon as the sponsee says they're done, the dictatorship is over. There's no reprisal. And often when you've got a tangled situation which doesn't work, I'm getting better at this. I'm not as good as I should be. Let go now, because I can't tell you how often I've really struggled with a sponsee, and it's so embarrassing. They go to someone, you think, my God, they've gone to them for sponsorship, and now they get sober. Now they get well from being told what I don't know what they're being told, but it worked. And all, you know, the aggregate wisdom that I had to offer did nothing. Useless. And they go to some Charlie that tells them to not to drink and go to meetings and to trust God. And suddenly they're fixed. So if it's not working, maybe it's not meant to work. Just try someone else. There's always plenty more. And it's not any. This is where I think we all work out our psychological quirks in sponsorship. Because if something goes super wrong, there's no harm. You don't want to be working out those quirks in intimate relationships or relationships with colleagues or bosses. Because if you mess that up, you're really messing stuff up. Whereas you can mess up stuff in sponsorship and people kind of bounce like dough. They bounce back into shape as long as they're going to, you know, 100,000 meetings. I think that was something else I've forgotten, but if it wants to come back, it'll come back. So if we see if there are any other questions.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Tim. Sarah Rivka, you have a question.
Hi, thanks. Thanks, Alistair. Thanks, Tim. I have a question. I've had the experience where a sponsee calls me up and tells me a story about something that happened and then says to me, how do you think I handled that? And I used to answer the question, and then lately I've been feeling like there's something wrong with that. I shouldn't really be giving an evaluation afterwards, or maybe I should be. I feel like it's a game, but I'm not sure. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Okay. It can be a setup, but it's not always a setup. There's a legitimate situation in which that occurs and a not so legitimate situation. Where it occurs legitimately, sometimes people are just faced with a situation suddenly. You just have to respond. And they're performing due diligence, as lawyers would say. They're making sure that what they did was fine, and to learn from it, to maybe react better or differently next time. But very often this occurs in a pattern where what someone is doing, they're doing what they want to do. They don't want to run it past a sponsor. They don't want to check it against the principles of the program. They want to do what they want to do, and heaven forbid they should pray. But what they want to do is do what they want to do. And then they want to get retroactive co-signature or papal blessing, papal dispensation, where you say, well, you were, it wasn't ideal, but, I forgive you and all that. They want to come clean and be forgiven. So often there's a psychological angle. This is very close to the question where they say, I've decided to ... What do you think? And that one, I've stopped answering. I'll say, I'll talk about this, but only if you undo your decision and are willing to go back and look at this. Have you really made your decision, or are you just considering it? If they said, no, I've made the decision, I'm just curious what you think, I won't give a view. I say, you have to ask me much earlier in the process, when you're still identifying if there's even a problem to solve. Because for a decision to be made, you've got to have a situation which calls for a response. You've got to identify what the options are. You've got to weigh them up. And then between those options, you make the decision. If they're bringing you in that late in the process, the problem is that they're not letting you play with a full deck of cards, because if you're really going to assess the situation, you have to assess whether there's a problem that needs to be solved. What are the options? Have you missed some? Have you got an option which shouldn't be on the list? Have you? Do you know what I mean? You're not being... I think one should be brought into these things. I don't go to my sponsor saying, I've decided to do this. I say, right, this is the situation I'm presented with. These are my thoughts about how I could handle it, but the whole thing is up for grabs. So I think with situations to deal with, I think that either the whole situation is up for grabs, or the thing is none of my business. But one's got to be able to look at all aspects of it, because otherwise what happens is you're painted into a corner where it's also the framing of the question. So the question that they pose often gives you two possibilities, both of which are disagreeable or inappropriate or not in accordance with the program. And the sponsee wants you to pick between the two. Whereas it's of the variety. I've robbed a bank. I was just in the middle of putting banknotes in my duffel bag, and we can hear sirens. And the question is, do I go into the vault and lock it behind me, or do I take one of the bank tellers hostage? Which of these two do you think they've painted you into a corner. You can't assess this situation, because the question is, why are you robbing a bank in the first place? But they've already presupposed that. They're already there. So I don't think that it's valuable for me to comment on situations where the horse has already bolted. You want to be brought in as someone to give input whilst the horse is still in the stable. So that's a very long way of answering your question. Generally, no, I don't think one should get involved. I think your instinct is right, but occasionally there's a legitimate reason why one might want to give input in that situation.
Thanks, Tim. Anyone else with a question for Tim? James.
Hi. Thanks, Tim. I think this is going to be one of these, is it not the case that parliamentary type questions. The situation I'm thinking of is out here in the sticks, where there's no daylight, as you can see. A lot of the meetings are kind of generic in nature. It's not like there are a mass of meetings and a few sort of good sharp ones, and that's where people gravitate. They're all a bit generic, and I've picked up people to sponsor over the years through those meetings. And there's a fair old attrition rate. If you get them sober in the first place, you get them to step five and they kind of disappear at that point. They might make a few amends and disappear at that point. Very few of them, in my observation, go on to sponsor, although a lot of them seem to wind up running meetings, and that's their form of service. And it struck me recently, it struck me quite forcibly, the little word "or" in the first paragraph of the chapter to agnostics, that we're dealing with a mixed population here, and about half the population, I would have said, are people who've not got the full deck of cards when it comes to alcoholism. They've got one part of the problem or another part of the problem, but they haven't got the whole thing, as I did. You know, I couldn't stop myself from drinking once I'd started, and I couldn't stop myself from starting, as opposed to "or". So I've sponsored a fair number of people who I think with hindsight didn't really need to be sponsored because they had the capacity to recover by non-spiritual means, to a certain degree, and that's exactly what they've done. So the sponsorship process, you know, going through the steps, as it were, has been overlaid onto that as a sort of bonus feature, I suppose. I don't think it's done any harm, but I'm not convinced it's been the best use of my time. Have you come across that distinction yourself in your extensive sponsorship life? How does one spot the difference, and does it really matter anyway?
It's a wonderful question. Okay. So I think a lot of people work the steps as a psychological, social, and material program. And they do the same instructions as you and I do. Exactly the same, but the angle is different. The purpose of it is not to be released from the matrix. It's to get on better in the world. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's not bad. It's just different. And now the jury is out for me on the question of reincarnation. However, I think some people on this journey, through the material plane, their job is to be totally involved in the material plane on this route through. Other people are so done with materialism, but are weirdly here for some reason, and are in just the most awful psychic pain until such point that they release themselves from themselves and find a way of being a channel for the higher power in the world. And that's why one is on the plane. And maybe there are lots of progressions one goes through. So I've known a lot of people in my early meetings, the people who were well psychologically and socially and spiritually and all those things fell into two groups. Group number one is people who were a mess when they got to AA, but basically sorted themselves out and had great lives and yachts, and they set up companies and They're basically, that's great for them. And they love it. And they're happy. And it genuinely works. It's not fool's gold. They've got gold. And then there are the kind of freaked out, psychologically maladjusted psychos like me. Now, if you're sponsored by the wrong type, if you're one of the psychos that, like me, that needs the spiritual awakening and the complete release from the material world, a sponsor who's of the first type is like a chocolate teapot. They do not know what to do with you. They just don't get it. You do the steps in a psychological, social and material way, and you're just as crazy as you were before. And they don't understand why. But the curious thing is, it can work the other way around. So I've had a lot of sponsees over the years who I gave them a spiritual program with practical instructions, but for them it was a psychological, social and material program, and they're out in the world and they're doing stuff, and they, most of them still go to meetings and, as you say, run meetings and do a bit of service, sponsor a couple of people, blah blah blah, and they're on a completely different, that their experience of the world is very, very different than mine. And you asked, and that's fine. Now you asked, is it worth sponsoring? Absolutely. Weirdly, it works that way around, but not the other way around. In my experience. Because otherwise they're going to die of alcoholism, drag, you know, scores of people into hell with them as they do it. So it's always worth it. You know, that it's the if someone stays sober, it's a benefit for thousands of people over the course of their life. So of course it's always, certainly I am not the person to judge. If someone comes to me for help, I give them the help or help them find someone who's suitable for them. Sometimes that's the job. I don't take everyone that asks me to sponsor them. But don't try and force the spiritual stuff on people who just don't want it. If they want to go another path, you haven't failed. My sponsor says your job is to take them it's like a relay race. You're taking them, you're accompanying them on this stretch of the race, and then someone else or some other situation is going to take them further. The biggest difficulty, and this is a common one, is you've got someone in category B who thinks they're in category A. In other words, you've got someone who desperately needs a spiritual solution and material solution, and they throw all the psychological, social and material stuff at it and it doesn't work, and they're still in the same psyche. Oh, there, I seem to be back.
Yeah, so most of it.
Much have you lost?
The last 20 seconds, perhaps, Tim.
You were just saying the problem is if someone's in category B.
Yeah,
category
B. Yeah. Okay. So it's like people are trying to, someone whose problem is essentially spiritual. In other words, it's their position in the universe. They're at the center. They need to be the servant of the higher power. But it's trying to tackle the problems from a psychological, social and material point of view. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't psychological and social and material problems to solve, but it means that that's not the prime focus. But there, all you can do is say, I think the solution here is spiritual, and hope they get it. Hope they get it. There's one last thing. My sponsor, his daughter is in AA, and she had in rural, semi-rural Texas, had a sponsor who was a Harley Davidson riding lesbian. So not your usual profile of a sort of Texan female sponsee. And someone said, you've got the wrong sponsor, little missy. And she said, yeah, but I've got the right higher power. So whatever force brings two people together, you have to figure that the higher power is working through it somehow. So the weirdest matches seem to work. We're at 8 o'clock and Roop's got a question. So maybe we can bring Roop in.
Yes, Roop.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Thanks for the presentation. I'm working with three sponsors at the moment, and I'm finding that having got through steps one to three, it's like, I'm not herding cats, but it seems to dissipate in step four and five. And yeah. Just want to be experienced in terms of, you know, the roles you've played or you found effective. Do you just let them go at their own pace and let them come back? Or do you just try to set some structure? What do you do?
Very, very simply, step four is a learning experience. So first of all, you're doing your step four, but secondly, you're learning how to do a step four. And the insights operate cumulatively and they overturn your whole perception and experience of the world when it's working. And now the reason I say that is because if you were learning Japanese, you'd have to put in a couple of hours a day. Otherwise, if you just did an hour a week, you'd spend the whole hour trying to regain what you'd learned the previous time and you wouldn't have any time to build on it. So you go around in circles and don't learn anything. And it's the same with step four. If you're bailing out a boat, there's still water coming in at the bottom. If you're only bailing out very, very slowly, the water's going to come in faster than you're bailing out. And then they feel that they're just getting worse, which they indeed are. So I think before I let people start step four, I say, are you willing to put 1 hour a day during weekdays, 2 hours a day or more at weekends into this, into writing, running it past other people? I get them to do daily work, run the daily work past someone else before they run it past me so that they're kind of, it's kind of pre-processed, that they've got worked the kinks out of it. And so they're doing it as a team effort between you and them and two or three confidants who are further ahead in the program. And that team effort seems to give people the encouragement and the support they need to get through it, because it's really hard. It's really hard. So I'd like sending them off into the night to just do the step four and hope they come back. They just won't come back. So since I put the structure in place, almost no one flakes out during step four. But it's the daily structure, the commitment before you start, daily structure, break it down into tiny bite-sized pieces every day. They read out what they wrote the day before so you can be making sure they're getting it right. They're getting stuff out of their system. They're not building up this huge backlog of stuff. And they're running it past someone else, which means they're getting rid of the guilt as they go. They're getting rid of the shame as they go. They're getting rid of the embarrassment. They're making friends. They're getting trained on the technical side by other people and not just you. You stop being the only person they're going to. You're less of an authority figure. You're just one in a chain of people they talk to. All of these things to contrive to making it easier for them to do the work. And you'll get, I think you get fewer dropouts if you do that.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Tim. And that's an appropriate point I have for everyone, I've just dropped into the chat the Google Drive with the previous recordings. If you want to copy that link. And with that, I think we'll hand the meeting back to Tim to ask him to close with the Serenity Prayers.
Thanks. Would you please join me in the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thanks.